Welcome to the latest Behind the Story podcast. I'm John Higginson, and today's episode is being recorded in Brighton at the Labour Party conference. I'm joined by founder and director of vegan charity Viva, Juliet Gellatley. Juliet founded Viva in 1994. She has investigated factory farming firsthand and is author of several books and guides. This year, Viva published a report, Envirucidal, which explores the devastating impacts livestock farming has on the planet. We're also joined by Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. Kerry was first elected to Parliament in 2005. She was the first vegan MP in the House of Commons and has been a vegan for more than 25 years. Kerry's main policy areas of interest are, correct me if I'm wrong, sustainability in the environment, food policy, the economy, tackling poverty, international aid and animal welfare. Before being elected to Parliament, Kerry worked as a lawyer and on political campaigns. And finally, we're joined by University of Oxford environmental researcher Joseph Paul. Last year, he was the lead researcher on a University of Oxford project which concluded going vegan is the single biggest way people can reduce their impact on the earth. Welcome to all of you. In just 30 minutes, all three of today's guests will be panellists at a fringe event, Vegan Now, the race against time for our planet. But first, the race against time to record this podcast. Julia, as the sponsor of today's panel, I'll start with you. Now we know the damage that we're doing to our planet through climate change. Can we really eat our way out of this mess?
If we all act quickly enough, yes, we can. There's still time. Time is running out. You're right, we all know this. We know the stark figures about global warming, that we need to change things within 12 to 20 years. What's talked about perhaps less often is the impact on wildlife. The United Nations have said now that 1 million species are at risk and we're in the sixth mass extinction. And what's spoken even less about, of course, is the impact of diet. When you look at something like the Amazon, 70,000 blazes that have happened this year alone, people may mention that it's due to cattle ranching, probably less so that it's due to the fodder. But what they don't say is that the exports from Brazil all over the world for meat consumption is what is driving the destruction of that forest. So it's directly through your diet that you're driving the loss. Now, the Amazonian rainforest, we know, holds about a tenth of the world's species. It produces, 20% of our oxygen. So it's extremely, extremely important that we change ourselves instead of waiting for politicians to act. And if you look at home, I mean, when I go and walk, say, the British Hilllands, and I'm going hiking, people say it's beautiful, and of course the panoramas are. But actually, there's almost no wildlife left. Since the beetle split up, we've probably lost about a half of Britain's wildlife. We're due to lose about 1 in 5 of our mammalian species in the next 10 years. You know, this is pretty stark stuff. And one of the things that's driving this is animal agriculture, because consuming meat takes up so much land, so much energy, produces so many more global warming gases than a plant-based diet, produces much more pollution, eutrophication and so on, that we simply cannot afford to do this anymore. As the human species, we are driving these animals to extinction directly through our own actions. But the good thing about veganism, and it's one of the reasons I love working on it, is that you don't need to lobby somebody else to change yourself. When you step into that supermarket or shop, you choose with your wallet what you buy.
Great. Joseph, you've done a report into this. How does going vegan compare to, say, some of the other things that people could individually do, like cutting out long-haul flights and other things?
First thing to probably say is that not that many people take long-haul flights. So it's while a long-haul flight, let's say from London to New York and back, a return flight in economy might be something in the region of 2 tons of CO2 per person. Very few people are taking them regularly, particularly at a global level. So,
how's that in kind of burger meat terms? How much meat do you have to be eating
Our diet in the UK probably creates about 2 tons of greenhouse gas emissions per person per year, but something that people don't really talk about or maybe recognise as much. So obviously, when you change your diet, you wouldn't just reduce those greenhouse gas emissions, you'd also free up significant amounts of farmland, which was kind of what Juliet was talking about. But that farmland would obviously, trees and natural vegetation would regrow and take carbon out the atmosphere. Right. So actually, if you look at the benefits of changing from a meat-based diet to a vegan diet in the UK, it's something in the region of a 3 or 4 ton per year reduction in your greenhouse gas emissions if you include the full supply chain, the full carbon benefits. And how does that stack up? So maybe that's two return long hauls from London to New York. Maybe it's 10 flights from London to Rome return, something like that. Okay. I don't know the precise numbers, but around that. So it stacks up.
And so actually, stacks up well. I never really thought about that double return because of the not having the embedded carbon within the meat itself, but also the land it frees up, and then that becoming a carbon capture if trees are replanted there. So that's a very good point. Kerry, you've been a vegan for 25 years and also a politician for a long time as well. Is it a vote winner being vegan, and how has it changed in recent years?
Yes, so it's actually 28 years now. It will be come January the 1st. And there's 5 of us now, 5 vegan MPs, 3 of whom are from Bristol. So that's pretty good going.
It does seem well,
I may have nudged them just over the line from vegetarianism. But yeah, I mean, when I was first elected, it was, you know, I was sort of widespread ridicule, it's got to be said, and fairly aggressive responses from some. And I've never really understood the extent to which some people seem to feel really threatened by you talking about your own beliefs and your own choices as to what you're going to consume. But certainly I did a debate on World Vegan Day in 2011, and it was the end of the day, and you normally wouldn't expect anyone to stay behind. And there was, a dozen or so people with farming interests that stayed behind just to shout at me. And there was a sort of mixture of that, but also, I think, partly because I was female, you know, the ridiculing thing as well. And we've come like an incredibly long way since then. So I first did a debate on the environmental impact of the livestock sector 10 years ago in March just gone. And now I'm finally getting colleagues that are, I'm actually even getting colleagues that are trying to persuade me of things. And it's like, you know, there's one colleague that was talking about bringing in a meat reduction bill. And he was making all these environmental arguments to me, and I was like, "Yeah, I know this, yeah. You know." And people, you know, even when I, you know, talked about methane from cows, people, you know, I made the Daily Mail for talking complete and utter nonsense. And it's now, I think that's the big change in the last few years, hasn't it? Being the environmental argument against meat eating, you know, the sort of ethical argument. I think you either feel that way or you don't, and the sort of things that Juliet's been doing by exposing the horrors of factory farming or even on some of the higher welfare farms, you know, that will help persuade people of the ethical case, but it's the environmental case that has really taken off, and it's now become almost quite mainstream, which is good.
Yeah, great. Well, Juliet, as Kerry's just pointed out there, some of that work that you've done on exposing some of those abuses in animal husbandry, what are the animals that actually have suffered the most, do you think? Both domestic animals that we're abusing through before slaughter or in dairy, but also wildlife. Which other wildlife is suffering the most, do you think?
The two things are so connected. In terms of suffering farmed animals, it's all of them, because if you look worldwide, there's probably about 28, 30 billion farmed animals on the planet right now, and the vast majority of those are intensively farmed. It's probably 4/5 globally, but it's even more than that in the UK. Right. And so you're looking, when we expose, for example, Hogwood Pig Farm through 3 investigations over 3 years, what I found going into that place was that I just found it hard to believe, despite all the investigations I've done, that this is still going on today in 2019, you know, and that the law is so pathetically weak that it's incredibly hard to prosecute large-scale intensive farmers. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing pigs that are dying in front of you with sores and lesions that have been there for a very long time, and with illnesses that they're never going to recover from, but just left in pain and dumped in gangways to die. You know, stuff like this. And then you highlight it to government, you highlight it to the in this case it was Tesco who was selling them, to Red Tractor who were approving them, and they all club together and say it's fine, go away, they meet standards. Until you get to the point where we left cameras in and showed human beings actually hitting the animals, and that was the turning point.
Right.
And then Tesco said, enough is enough, And yeah. Of course, they never met standards all the way along. But yeah. My point is, the reason I'm mentioning Hogwood is because that was a so-called mega farm that's typical of factory farming. And that's the really sad thing. And I think, you know, people find that really hard to understand, that this is where our meat is coming from in the UK. And you look at chicken farming, of course, we eat chickens by far the most in terms of numbers of animals, and almost all of them, about 99%, are factory farmed intensively and suffer hugely because they've been selectively bred to grow far too fast, so they collapse in on themselves, their bones collapse, their hearts give out, and they're only killed at 6 weeks old, and you've got millions dying from heart disease, totally human-made disease in these birds. So you've got all this suffering going on within the farmed animals, but then through eating the animals, we're causing all this destruction and death of wildlife. So just jumping back, because I'm using the Amazon rainforest as an example, you've got the Brazilian president encouraging farmers to set fire to the rainforest to directly graze cattle or grow fodder to export all over the world for meat consumption. And so you've got in the Amazon, these animals are not have not evolved to cope with fire at all. So it really saddens me. You've got species that are already on the at-risk list who are now being pushed to extinction. Several species of mammals, different species of monkeys. The Amazonian jaguar is now being killed directly by the ranchers, and also their prey is disappearing and their homes are disappearing. So now they're on the threatened list. And so it goes on. You look through mammalian species worldwide. I think it's about a quarter on the threatened list for extinction. You look at birds, it's about 14%. You look at amphibians, they're really in trouble. It's over 40%. And so it goes on. So in answer to your question, it's totally across the board.
So I think as we kind of pointed out, there has been a bit of a turning point where certain people that wouldn't have come into veganism previously have come in. And I know that, Juliet, you've mentioned there's two ways they've come in. One through environmentalism and the other is through health as well. But we will park health because we don't have enough time on that on the podcast. But if we say that veganism is one of the answers to the environmental problem that we face, how do we bring people with us on that? Because as you say, until you really put the issues around animal husbandry right in people's face, people prefer to say, I know it might be happening, but I like eating meat and I don't really want to see that video, thanks very much. How do you, what's the way that you're working now in a different way?
We're working in every way, because if there was the silver bullet, we would have used it. And what I found is I was, believe it or not, the first person to campaign on vegetarianism in the UK. That's how old I am. But I was employed as the first campaigner, literally, back then. And so the reason I'm saying that is that I have seen the changes in attitude from, I mean, just beyond all, you know, imagination, really, where veganism was seen as radical and extreme, and food manufacturers wouldn't even go near the word, even when they were producing vegan foods, to the absolute opposite today, where they're falling over themselves to say who is doing the best vegan menus, not options, menus.
Yeah.
And supermarkets are actually arguing with each other about who provides the most vegan food. Sainsbury's, just as an example, they're saying that a quarter of the UK is going to be vegan. This is Sainsbury's saying this, by about 2025. So they're saying Britain really is changing, and they're seeing it on the shop front, so to speak. So in terms of campaigning, it depends very much on the age groups, because if you're talking to younger people, then if you show them factory farming, then it works and they will change overnight and they are very receptive to it. If you talk about the environment, you're talking about, yes, teenagers, but an older age group as well. So, I mean, you know those anecdotes. Well, I've spoken to so many thousands of people, but this is one of the typical ones. I had an Italian guy who came up to me, who runs a restaurant, and he goes, Juliet, for the environment, I have to go vegan. I have to face it. And this is the kind of guy that you would never have thought would have said this just 3 years ago.
I've got friends in the same position doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So, Kerry, we are at Labour Party conference. This is, we are perhaps months away from a general election. What would you do tomorrow if the Labour Party is in and you are...
If I was in charge,
What would you do to encourage this this move to veganism?
Yeah, I think that there's a few things. One is to actually set targets for reduction of meat consumption. And it was really disappointing, the Committee on Climate Change issued its report on reaching net zero recently. I went along to the launch and the chair of the committee, Lord Debbins, said, my least favourite environmentalists are those that want you to have a cold house and eat disgusting food. And I was like, what does he mean, disgusting food? I knew what he meant. And he basically meant, he was basically saying, you can't persuade people to eat disgusting food, by which he meant plant-based. So their recommendation was 20% reduction in red meat consumption, but switch towards eating pigs and poultry instead. And I think Juliet's, you know, told us what's wrong with eating pigs and poultry instead, although there's also the health arguments as well as other concerns. And yeah, that lack of ambition, and it's so much less than the UN have said, the IPCC, all these other bodies have said that we've got to be far more ambitious than that. So I would want a target for, you know, where we actually build into, the government has now got this goal of reaching net zero by 2050. Most of the conversations in Parliament are about energy use, so fossil fuels, a bit about solar panels on houses, a bit about electric cars. Nobody talks about food and land use. And I think the Amazon was a real wake-up call for quite a lot of people. And as you say, it works both ways. It's that, you know, the environmental impact of it being used for livestock feed or for cattle farming, but also the fact that you're removing one of the Earth's largest carbon sinks is really important. So there's that, and we have to look at the way that we reward our farmers for doing the right thing. The other thing is about public procurement. I think you could really make huge progress if we... we've seen stories this week of universities going back and either going meat-free or having purely vegetarian or vegan cafes on campus, which is a really good lead. And I think that if we could tie in the sort of things that we put public money into, so the NHS... free school meals, all those sort of things, and link it towards a plant-based diet as opposed to funding unhealthy food, those things would be good. There's a lot more that you could do, because I think we've come a long way with consumers making their own decisions, with the market responding and in some ways leading that. But until the government gets involved, you don't get those sort of seismic changes that you really want to see, given the scale of the emergency. You know, we haven't got time to everybody to gradually get the message.
Yeah. Kerry just spoke about universities there. What are things looking like at Oxford University? Will that go vegan only anytime soon?
I doubt it.
great. Well, look.
possibly you'd hope they would take a more... proactive policy in this area. I think there's some work going on, but it's not like that. I can't really comment on it.
Good. One last question then. If you are inviting someone over for dinner, and you're making them try and win them over to become a vegan meal, what's your go-to meal? Any answers here? What is your
I tell you, risotto goes down fairly well, I think, because you can sort of do something they wouldn't necessarily expect to find lots of meat in risotto, but I would just normally get just a curry, a takeaway, that's better than anything I could cook.
I kind of go for... cuisines from around the world. I've tried things like Thai green curries with people, which go down really, really well. Chinese food, a mix of, really well. And Italian. Yeah. I mean, because it all lends itself to vegan cooking anyway.
Yeah. And are you doing substitutes there, where you're using corn instead of beef, or are you going for something that was never had any meat in Italian?
I tend to celebrate the plant kingdom for itself, so try and be a bit imaginative rather than sort of relying on substitutes. But having said that, do use them sometimes as well.
Yeah. I quite like a white bean called coco de pampol, which is a French bean. Mm. And I can make a nice salad out of it.
Very nice. Well, thank you very much indeed, all of you. Thanks for listening to the Behind the Story podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please tweet us at Higginson Tweets and let us know your thoughts. Until next time.